It's the time set for oral argument.
Oops, sorry.
Thank you. The time set for oral argument for the Southern panel. The first case on our docket is Daryl E. White versus State of Nevada Division of Forestry et al. Case number 76737. Okay, Mr. Barron, Mr. Schwartz, ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
If I may, Your Honor, Travis Burke on behalf of Mr. White, who's here today.
Hello, Mr. White.
And if it pleases the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal and allow Nathan Lawrence here, my colleague, to handle that.
Okay.
Moving on, I'd like to make a brief opening statement and then really turn our attention and our conversation to questions from the bench. I could talk for hours about this case, but I'm much more interested in the court's questions. So if you're leaked, that's all right.
However you'd like to proceed, Mr. Barrick, I have a couple of questions for you. If there's something you want to begin with, go ahead.
Very brief. There's a famous German theologian from World War II, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who spent some time in the dungeons of the prison in Dresden, kind of shapes his worldview. And he pondered the question, what is folly? Why do people, even smart people, do silly things? And we think that's why we're here today. How did we get here today? Because we believe that the outcome that brought us here today is absurd, right? So Bonhoeffer observed that folly is not a sign of an intellectual defect. It's evidence of a moral problem. So we're here today because there's a moral issue behind the persistent denial of the respondents to give Mr. White what he was due. The arguments by the respondents are cogent, linear, easy to follow, backed up with all sorts of case law, but the result that they're defending is absurd. And I remember introducing some law students to Justice Pickering at a social event. And I asked her, well, what would you tell these brand new law students? And she said, well, don't save your best argument for last. And in this case, I think that's what we've done. That the real argument that would allow the court to remand this case down to district court with an order to recalculate Mr. White's average minimum wage is the argument that we kind of brought up last, which was wage is not limited to money paid. It includes the value of goods and services. And that calculation has never been performed. So it would be our ask that the court remand this case with an order to recalculate his average monthly wage to include the totality of his wage for the time period that it deems relevant. It would also be nice if the court would address the possibility of attorney's fees in this case, because of course the value of Mr. White's damages or recovery and recalculation isn't that much money, which makes the fact that we're here today, 3.5 years later, a little more aggravating, that a problem as unique as this could not have been solved earlier. And so here we are, 3.5 years later. And so, begging the court, in its order, should we be the prevailing party to at least address whether or not Mr. White's fees can be covered by the respondents, all predicated on a favorable ruling.
How do you distinguish the Pierre versus DCI Plasma Center of Nevada case with what we're talking about here with minimum wages while incarcerated?
I don't know. What's the nut question?
So the question is, the Supreme Court has spoken on what the on the fact that inmates do not receive minimum wage in prison. It's not unconstitutional. And one of your arguments, I thought, was that this is unconstitutional.
It is. The issue is not, does an inmate get the minimum wage? Mr. White was not an inmate when he was in care. He had been released. He had expired his sentence. So, to quote a dear friend, what the defendants are saying is, yes, Mr. White, we'll calculate your average monthly wage for an inmate that cut wood would get if an inmate who cut wood could. Kind of a tongue twister. The point is, they're saying, even after you're released, we're only going to pay you at the amount due an inmate when you are no longer an inmate. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Barrick has calculated, if I'm correct, calculated at the time of injury. Time of injury, he was an inmate. And you're asking us to define wages differently than NAC 616B964 defines wages, which doesn't include room and board, the value of less time, etc. So how do we not apply the NAC in this context?
Well, I think this is the nut of the argument, is NAC 616C420 says the value of all good money, goods, and services. So the fact that that may not have been included in every section, to us, is not dispositive. So we think that in his case, you have to include the value of room and board.
But 616B964 specifically refers to inmates.
I understand.
So why wouldn't we apply the specific NAC to him?
Because that applied to him when he was an inmate. You brought us back to the issue of date of injury. And that was one of my original tracks in this case to try and distinguish it, about date of injury. But again, remember, he's not an inmate when his benefits start. He's been released. He's out of custody. He's not even on parole. And so here's the problem. What we're all struggling about is, how do we find a way to rectify this absurd result? We wouldn't be here if it wasn't absurd. And that's why I come back to, I think the court would be on solid ground to using NAC 616C to include the value of his wages, in a sense, if you will, filling in a gap that's in 616B. Because I just don't think they ever addressed it or thought that it would happen. This is such an unusual case. Does that answer your question? I tried to.
Of course. Well, 616B982... says the fact that an offender has earned a relatively low wage during incarceration is not a ground for reopening of a claim. So certainly the statutory scheme and the rules have contemplated that inmates are undercompensated, so to speak, when they're in.
Yeah, we get.
We determine wage by the date of injury. At the date of injury, his wage was 50 cents a day. Help me find a statutory way forward for what you're asking us to do.
Well, you have really good law clerks. I wish I had an answer for you about how to find a way out of this bizarre result. And again, I don't know how to reconcile the two. I just know that in the background, something's wrong. Right? Something is wrong, that it's okay to release somebody to the streets in an injured condition, requiring surgery and therapy, and then decide that it's okay to just pay him a wage based on 50 cents a day. The only beneficiary of that is the carrier.
Let me split those two things. The medical care is taken care of, correct?
Correct.
This is only about the wage claim.
It is.
And wouldn't you talk about the carrier? Wouldn't a carrier have done all their numbers and their math based on the fact that the people who they're covering in the prisons earn 50 cents a day as opposed to the minimum wage? Doesn't that kind of make sense?
It does. Which kills me why we were unable to settle this case a long time ago. Because if we win, that's messed up for them. Seriously, right? Because now it's like, oh, the problem with that argument that they should make, that I would if I was Mr. Schwartz, is, well, that opens the floodgates. But the problem with that argument is, this never happens. How often does this actually happen where somebody is released from prison, injured on the job, in a paid position, and into a workers' comp claim?
So, Mr. Barrick, I appreciate the passion that you have for this issue and for this case. And on the surface, I also respect the fact that it seems unfair that the amount of average monthly wage to be paid is so low. What I was going to ask you to address and what I'm going to ask counsel to address is in the statutory construct dealing with prisoners, years ago, this problem was addressed in the Nevada Administrative Code when the division was expected, when the Director of Prisons was expected to provide regulations that spelled out the modified workers' compensation program for prisoners at Nevada Administrative Code 616B960 through 616B986. And what is significant about that program, this is a workers' compensation insurance benefit program for prisoners. It includes 616B964, subparagraph 1, which defines wages. And in doing so, it says the following. This is the money an inmate earns in the prison industry program before any deductions are made from those earnings. Wages do not include the value of room and board, medical care and other goods and services, and the value of good time earned towards sentence reduction or income from any source other than the prison industry program. Why shouldn't we apply the insurance program that is outlined in the Nevada Administrative Code so explicitly?
The only reason that I have is that he was not an inmate. At the time he was released from prison, he was no longer an inmate. He was an injured worker. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason I have, because I have to eat that.
Your argument in your briefs included an argument that this definition, strike that, you didn't address this definition, neither did the state for that matter, which is disconcerting. But because we did research this extensively. Even the hearing officer and the calculations provided by the insurance company didn't address this regulation. That's disconcerting. But we are governed by the law, and we are governed by the regulations that provide for this insurance program. And this modified workers' compensation program for prisoners spells out what constitutes wages for an injured prisoner. And it excludes the things that you're asking for, such as Mr. White's room and board, Mr. White's value of his services outside of his compensation through the industry program. So the only remaining argument that I can see is this regulation unconstitutional because it violates Nevada's minimum wage law? Would you care to address that question?
Your Honor, I really hope that the court runs with that argument, because that's a great one, right? That regulation, there is a higher law. And the court, of course, here, as you stated, is bound to enforce the laws it's written. But there is a higher law out there that supersedes the NACs and the NRS, and that's the state constitution. As to the failure to address that definition, my apologies.
Your time is running on your co-counsel's
report. I'm sorry, I was not paying attention to
so that. You might want to close it off here so that you've got a little bit of rebuttal time left.
Thank you. Was there a clock up here?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That's what it's there for.
I see it now. Thank you.
You're done.
Thank you.
Eric. Thank you. I don't mean to be rude. It's just you're out of time.
Thanks, sir.
Mr. Schwartz.
May it please the court, Daniel Schwartz on behalf of the respondents in this matter.
Counsel, I think the panel is very familiar with the facts here. We're very familiar with the arguments. I'd like you to address the question I just posed.
The constitutionality question?
Well, let's begin with the regulatory construct. Nobody's arguing the right regulatory construct that I can see.
And
am I correct?
You are correct.
That the Director of Prisons established a modified prison program.
Correct.
Under these regulations.
Correct. And that's actually...
And that's not in your brief.
And what
is it?
No, Your Honor, it's not.
What do we do with that? Because it doesn't appear to have been in the administrative hearing officer's decision either.
The process before the appeals officer was not very long. We both, counsel and I, knew that they weren't going to change the law. So we pushed the case forward, in essence. And as counsel started his argument with some philosophy quotes about changing and shaping your world's view, I am a workers' comp attorney. I have done workers' comp for 25 years. Until 2 days ago, I didn't even know that Section 209 of the Nevada Revised Statutes existed. Section 209 of the Nevada Revised Statutes answers every question that was raised by counsel in his brief. That is the statute that started the program that Your Honor has just addressed, that gives the director the power to establish a program and to establish wage base. It also says that the director has to meet annually with a committee that's made up of part of the legislature. I know that question was raised before, that maybe the legislature didn't know what was happening. Well, they did, based on Section 209. But even more importantly, based on Section 209.461, they've addressed the minimum wage question. It's in the statute. It says that not only does an inmate worker within this program not have the right to state or federal minimum wage, but subsection 8 actually says they're not allowed to bring a cause of action to ask for it.
So that leads to this question. Part of the reason we want a oral argument on this case is because none of this stuff's in your briefs.
I understand.
But there is a very disconcerting issue to me. The Constitution was amended by the voters of this state to create and later adjust a minimum wage. Why doesn't that provision of the Constitution apply to this regulation, making this calculation for wages in this context unconstitutional?
And I would argue three things, Your Honor.
Okay.
First, again, it's not in either one of our briefs, but Section 209 does specifically address this question. It's a statute.
Mm-hmm.
It's given the deference.
So perhaps that provision, that statute is unconstitutional.
Well, my second argument, Your Honor, would be in the context of Mr. White, he doesn't even have the ability to be here to make this argument pursuant to 209, because 209 subsection 8 actually says he cannot bring a cause of action to ask for minimum wage. I don't think they contemplated within the workers' comp system. I think they contemplated a wage and hour type case, but we're here today. And so that would be my second argument. And then my third argument, Your Honor, would be that the way that at least this court in the past has construed statutory construction, when you have a clear statement, and I don't think we can argue, well, Your Honors can argue anything you want, obviously. I can't argue that Section 209 is not clear in stating that an inmate within this program is not entitled to minimum wage. Pursuant to the Allen v. State case, that's clear. It's given the constitutional presumption because it's clear. There's no question. There's no interpretation The statute says exactly what it says. And that program was created, again, if you look in 209, with all of this in mind. Counsel talked to us about this is just one strange case that just happened to end up here. No, it's actually every single inmate worker within this program. The director of the program is mandated by statute, also in 209, to make a profit. He has no choice. If the program makes no profit, there will be no program. So when counsel says, well, the carrier argument, we're not a carrier. I mean, just so we're clear, there's no carrier in this case. This is the state of Nevada. This is their money, their case, their program that they're mandated to have, their program that they're mandated to profit, their program that the director is mandated to report to the legislature every single year, issues just like this question. What are you paying your inmate workers? And every year, year after year after year, this has been reported to the legislature, and the legislature has never changed Section 209 to reflect that we should pay the minimum wage.
But that takes us to the question I posed. Is the statute and the regulations that creates this modified program for prisoners that defines wages in the manner that I just read unconstitutional under our constitutional requirement that someone who's earning wages be paid a minimum wage?
And my response to that, Your Honor, would be if you look at not only 209, but also if you look within the Nevada Revised Statute 616 and 616 of the Nevada Administrative Code, for the most part, prison inmate workers are not deemed to be employees. They're deemed to be prison inmate workers who are covered by a different set of statutes and a different set of codes. So I don't believe when we drafted the statutes that indicate that everyone in the state of Nevada is entitled to a minimum wage, that was entitled to encompass employees under Section 209.
But there's a marked difference between where these provisions come from. The minimum wage is in our Constitution.
Correct.
The statutory program is in our statutes. So this is the conundrum that I think this panel is faced with without the benefit of any briefing on this subject. And the real issue is whether the use of the word wages in calculating average minimum wage for purposes of disability has the same meaning as minimum wages in the Constitution. The average minimum wage seems to be focused on a benefit for an injured employee, not a wage. But we don't have the benefit of any research from you guys on this at all.
May I just reach over here for a second?
Sure.
And I only ask to do that, Your Honor, because this argument was actually raised twice and published Supreme Court decisions from other jurisdictions,
yes.
And both of which held that it was constitutional, even though the state of California has a very similar constitutional mandate for minimum wage, and the state of Washington has a very similar constitutional mandate for minimum wage.
You're about to cite stuff that you didn't put in your briefs.
You're correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mr. Schwartz, do you appreciate... I'm sorry, Chief Young.
Yeah, go ahead.
In the minimum wage context within the prison, well, I want to take that piece out. Don't you agree that there'd be a difference between saying someone has to earn a minimum wage while they're incarcerated as opposed to, as my colleague pointed out, wage replacement being a benefit of the disability when you're out? And it would seem you have inmates fighting fires on behalf of the state, earning presumably 50 cents a day. If somebody's seriously burned or injured and then they get out, you're going to give them 50 cents a day? I mean, there's something about that seems to kind of offend or shock the conscience a bit.
Well, I think the response to that is that we have statutes and case law that indicate that your wage is set on the date of injury.
Sure.
And that has really never been questioned. I mean, it's been questioned once before, but the Supreme mm-hmm. Court has come back and said
right.
It is set on the date of injury.
Sure.
So we have to set a wage, whatever that wage may be. But I think what we're doing, or at least in my humble opinion, what we're doing is we're putting too much emphasis on the amount of money that this inmate worker puts in their pocket and not the other benefits that come along with it. This is a voluntary program. It's not slavery or involuntary servitude. It's a voluntary program that the inmate workers do because they carve time off their sentence.
Right, so they get a benefit from it.
They get a benefit.
But the NAC itself says we don't consider that in the wage. So it's kind of like a shield and sword.
Well,
so
it's not a wage, though. Yeah. I mean, it's actually, it could be argued it's the exact opposite. Because if you look at 209, 209 also talks about the fact that depending on how much you're earning, I can deduct things like your room and board from your wage. So that's not, the benefit is to all by cutting the amount of time on the sentence. I mean, I'm assuming someone is regulating that. That's not within our today's discussion. But the benefit is to all to cut time off that sentence, to the inmate worker because they get out earlier, and to the state because we obviously don't have to pay for that inmate worker or that inmate to be incarcerated. So this has never been designed, at least when you look at the 209 and its history, this has never been designed to be a money maker for the inmate worker. It's a way for the inmate worker to get out early and to get something for doing the work they're doing. As far as your question with the one who gets seriously burned, you're correct. And they mostly they do is they handle forestry issues, which include fighting forest fires. Mm-hmm. And if they get seriously burned, or in the case of Mr. White, if they get seriously injured, we take care of all of their medical bills. We take care of any time they might be off work as a result of the injury. We take care of whatever a injured worker would get once they are released from jail. They're not entitled to temporary total disability benefits while incarcerated because we have statutory authority for that. So once they're not incarcerated, they would be entitled to the full gamut of benefits as any other injured worker.
To your knowledge, in your experience, has this issue come up yet before this court?
This particular issue?
Yes.
Not that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Unless you have any additional arguments.
I did want to add one more comment to the constitutionality argument. Mm-hmm. If you look in the Nevada Revised Statutes under 616B, you will see a list of 15 different types of entities, employees, whatever we want to call them, who have deemed wages. Many of those have never been changed. They've never been challenged. They've never been changed. They're not minimum wage. So a housekeeper, for example, under that particular statute, has a deemed wage. Someone who works in a temporary job for a limited period of time but still covered under workers' compensation has a deemed wage. So the legislature did consider the idea of deemed wages or set wages within the workers' comp context, not only in 616B, but also in 209. And then I would close, Your Honors, with that the statement again, that under 209 subsection 8, I'm not even sure I would hear, because technically Mr. White doesn't have the ability to challenge it when he is an inmate worker.
You didn't argue that.
My only retort to that, Your Honor, would be it's a subject matter jurisdiction issue that I believe I can raise at any time, but I obviously will defer to you.
Well, this takes us full circle to the question I've been posing during this argument. If that provision is unconstitutional under the minimum wage provision of our Constitution, then he has a right to be here. Unfortunately, we don't have his standing or lack of it briefed. It wasn't asserted in front of the hearing officer below or the district court, for that matter, by either party. So it is really troublesome that an issue of this import comes to us in this particular situation. I'm not trying to disparage anybody, but I do think that you're correct that there is a clear path outlined in the statute and in the regulations for answering this question. What's unfortunate is whether that path is impaired by the provisions of the Constitution itself, and we don't have the benefit of those arguments. I don't mean to cut you off about the citation to those state cases. We know those. We've developed those in our own research, but they weren't argued in the briefs, so it's not fair to argue them now unless there is supplemental briefing in this case. My question to you, and it will be to counsel on the rebuttal, and he'll get 2 minutes, is do you want supplemental briefing on the question I've raised?
I would be happy to provide supplemental briefing on that, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Thank you. And likewise, if supplemental briefing is required, we'll be happy to do so.
I think...
What's your name, sir?
Oh, I'm sorry, Nathan Lawrence.
Okay, good morning, Mr. Lawrence.
I wasn't on the original.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence.
I'm going to backtrack real quickly for 30 seconds. I think there is a way under the NAC to actually get there. As we talked about specifically NAC 616B, I believe you had said 960B1, is the one that basically excludes inmates' wages, or excludes from inmates' wages, such things as room and board and all that. I think 616B exists in the entire context. NAC 616C, which is not directed specifically to prisoners, but does encompass the entire workers' program, says specifically in 616C.423, items included in the average monthly wage as it's calculated are the money, goods, and services which are paid within the period used to calculate the AMW. They include but are not limited to wages. So even though inside 616B, where it says an inmate's wages are, do not include these things, we're not limited to that definition of wages. We can drag other things back in, I think.
I appreciate your point, Mr. Lawrence, but once again, that wasn't argued in your briefs either.
Understood.
And, you know, quite frankly, this is very disconcerting that we're making this stuff up as we go.
Are you, Your Honor.
Are you completed with your argument?
No. I'm not.
You're out of time.
So on the due process argument,
Go ahead.
On the due process argument, I think that really comes down to the ultimate issue of it is the question of the constitutionality of it. Even though the other things may be contemplated, NRS 616C basically allows that the right gets taken away from the prison, and this was argued in our brief. The right gets taken away from somebody who's incarcerated for the period in which they're incarcerated. Once the incarceration is completed, they're restored that economic right in full. What we have here, and I believe Mr. White has standing because he brought this case as a free man, not an inmate, challenging what the inmate receives in the prison. So that's a point of distinction. But what they would do is they end up restoring, by the interpretation they provide, they end up restoring a diminished economic right. Instead of saying you're entitled to receive a full average monthly wage as a free person, we are going to give you a lesser wage. So, in effect, the diminution of the economic right becomes a deprivation of that economic right. It's essentially a constitutional taking under a due process consideration, both under procedural and substantive. The procedural issue is basically, I don't have sites for it in the thing, but I think this is common enough knowledge relative to this issue, is you have to be addressing first an entitlement, not something that's a unilateral expectation. I think that's directed under force in 616C, which says the individual again becomes, in the language of the law, is entitled to receive such benefits. That constitutes an entitlement, not Mr. White's subjective expectation. So I think the first hurdle is met. The second one requires a notice. The fact that other analogous statutes point to situations where that right is restored, they're given the exact opposite notice. There's an expectation that you will receive the full restoration of your economic rights once received.
Okay, Mr. Lawrence, you've run out of time, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not going to submit the case yet. The panel will discuss what our next steps will be. If we seek a supplemental briefing, an order will issue. Otherwise, I'll enter an order that submits the case, but we want to deliberate on this question first. This is an important question. The fact that Mr. White is an inmate who has done his time and is out, this is a significant issue for him, and it's a significant issue for the state of Nevada, because as Justice Stiglitz points out, you got a lot of folks that are working in the industry program who sadly may get injured and raise issues similar to this, and how they're compensated with a temporary permanent disability or temporary or permanent disability is a big question. Thank you for your arguments this morning, and I won't submit it at this point until we've had a chance to conference.